now to Victorian England. They had all these pea super fogs because of the Industrial Revolution. So there was all dark streets in around the east end of London. And there, plying his trade, was Jack the Ripper. But who was he? Well, the cool scientist has been monitoring reports about discoveries related to Jack the Ripper, and he's here to report. That is Sean Duke at SeanDuke.com. Good morning, Sean.
Yeah, we can announce this morning who he was.
Really?
Well,
yeah.
We think we can. It looks pretty conclusive. So, as lots of people will know, people are fascinated by the Jack the Ripper story. I know I am myself. I went on the Ripper tour in the East London, and this concerns the evidence. There's forensic evidence that has been presented in a book by a guy called Russell Edwards, and he's saying that he's now knows conclusively who the person is, and it's one of the suspects, he says. So the person in mind that he has in mind is a guy called Aaron Kosminski, who was 23 at the time, and he was a suspect. Now, where does the evidence come from? Well, there was a shawl found at the scene of one of the crimes, a particularly horrific one. Catherine Eddowes, she was 46 years old, and she was a prostitute, and the Ripper committed what was called a double murder, double event. The only time he committed two murders on the same night, she was unfortunately one of them, Catherine, and at the scene, which was horrific, we won't go into the details too much, but he basically, among other things, he disfigured her and stole her kidney, and absolutely. And this is why they thought that the Ripper had some kind of knowledge of surgery, because all of this happened within a couple of minutes. Because when the police actually found Catherine, she was still warm, and they figured it only happened. And it was in an area, I've been there myself, which is very, very central in London. You're right beside the Thames. There were people around, so he had to work quickly. In any case, This shawl was found, and a policeman called Amos Simpson, he was on duty the particular night, and he, for some reason, decided to take the shawl home and gave it to his wife. And his wife wasn't impressed at all. She thought, this is horrific. It was soaked in blood, and she never wore or washed it. That's the story in this particular book. And it was just kept as a family heirloom. Years and years later, the author of this book bought the shawl at an auction, and he came up with the idea, let's try and forensically test this shawl to see if there are any blood or bodily fluids on it from whoever the Ripper is and from Catherine. So the shawl could definitely be placed at the scene of the crime. So he got a scientist involved in his project, and they managed to track down the living descendants of Catherine Eddowes, the woman who was killed, and Kosminski, the guy that they had in mind, the suspect that they had in mind. And they found that the DNA on the blood, in other words, or the bodily fluids, shall we say, that came from the Ripper, we won't say any more than that, they saw that there was a link between the relatives of Catherine and Kosminski and the shawl. So there was a physical link there. Now, this is very, very interesting. The thing about it is that it's early days, and of course, what scientists will want to do is they will want to look at the experiment that was performed and make sure there wasn't what they call cross-contamination, you know, DNA being messed around with. They'll want to replicate the experiment. They'll want to, you know, other labs will want to do blind experiments, which means, you know, testing without having any bias towards one result or another. But they're going to do all of this, and if you want to read about this, in any case, there's a book out, Naming Jack the Ripper, by Russell Edwards, and it looks very interesting based on this new DNA evidence.
And from you reading it, do you think they've cracked the mystery?
It looks very, very convincing. I mean, the only thing that could knock it down here is this cross-contamination, so that, you know, maybe they mixed up the DNA when they were doing it. But the scientist involved is quite reputable. You know, so unless there's been a very basic mistake made in how they handled the DNA, it looks like they've got their man. And it wouldn't be a huge surprise, because Kosminski, who is this Polish Jew who had emigrated from Poland to escape basically pogroms or persecution in Poland, he was a suspect. anyway. The police had him as a suspect, but they didn't have any evidence. Interestingly enough, on the night Catherine was killed, there were three people who saw her talking with a man. Now, this particular area, if anybody's been there, it's pretty dark. You can still go there. It's still more or less the same as it was all that time ago, 126 years ago. One of the witnesses provided a pretty good description of the man, who he had a moustache, he was of a certain height and a certain build, and this matched Kosminski. So this was one of the reasons that he was in the frame. So we have that eyewitness account from all those years ago, which I think is the only eyewitness account of the Ripper. And now we have this DNA evidence. Now, until we say the Ripper thing is solved, we can't say that 100% until this DNA experiment has been replicated by other labs. But certainly, it's very, very interesting, and it looks like they may have their man.
Okay, fair enough.
I'll be reading the book anyway.
He's supposed to be some sort of a friend of Queen Victoria, wasn't he?
Oh, no, that was a different chap who
was...
Because, you see, the doctors were in the frame. He was a doctor who was linked with the royal family because somebody with surgical knowledge, they reckoned. So doctors were being looked at. But also, somebody who worked with animals, anybody who worked with animals, who was involved in butchering animals, stuff like that, would have been able to do this as well. So that's what Kosminski wasn't a doctor, but he was involved in the other stuff.
Right. Mm. Another fascinating story, and we're going to talk about carbon, because carbon is in news because we have too much of it in the world, seemingly, and it's messing up all the weather and the climate change and all that. But we're made up of carbon, and at least part of us are. And we're going to talk about carbon very soon with Sean. It's Sean Duke at seanduke.com, our cool scientist. But right now you're going to talk to us about telepathic communication achieved for the first time from brain to brain.
Yeah.
So how does this work?
This is amazing. This is where we're going into the future. So this has been a very basic contact or communication that's been made by two brains, one located in India, one located in France. This has been done by Harvard University, so it's very reputable. And ultimately where this is going, I'll explain what they did in a second, is that we, instead of using, for example, the internet to type an email message to somebody, you could have a situation where somebody is thinking in Ireland and they're transmitting their thoughts over to New York and back and forth. So the actual physical thing is removed. It's just direct brain-to-brain communication. So that's where we're headed. So what they did here was that when you think, the first thing to say, I suppose, is when you think, it's you create electricity. So that's how you read a thought. When you're thinking a particular word, that creates an electrical signal in your brain that can be read. So when I think Declan, for example, or East Coast,
you come over all happy.
There's a big peak and very flush or whatever. So anyway, but scientists can then, by repeating this over, they can see that the electrical activity is always the same for a particular word in a particular person. So you can mind read. They essentially can mind read. Okay. So what they've done here is they've got one brain, essentially, in one place, one person's brain, to just think and say hello. Then the computer translates the electrical readout into binary code. That's ones and zeros. So that's the code that's used in our computers. It's just ones and zeros. So it's a computer code, essentially. Then this was emailed from India to France. And then the brain in the other location was then shown flashes of light just at their peripheral vision, at the side of their vision. And this is another form of message that you can take. It's a different type of readout, but they were then able to understand that the other person had said hello. So it's a combination of electricity and light, and using the manipulating the way that we receive and transmit information. But between the jigs and the reels, the hello, the brain said hello in India, and the other brain in France was able to understand that hello had been said, and it was direct brain-to-brain communication.
So the thing we have to do is to harness this.
To harness this, exactly. To harness this. So, you know, people say that we're very lazy because we're using computers and we're typing and stuff. Maybe we're going to get even lazier because we'll just think, you know, instead of actually typing an email, maybe we'll just think a message and the thought will get transmitted to whomever we want to transmit the thought to. Now, whether we want all our thoughts read by somebody else, I don't know. Maybe it's nice in a way to have a bit of privacy inside our brain, but
that's the way we're going.
Yeah, that's the way we're going.
Okay, it's Sean Duke, SeanDuke.com. He's our cool scientist. And Sean is going to talk to us now about carbon. We hear various things about carbon in the world. Oh, it's all the carbon gases and all that sort of stuff. But aren't we carbon? So, Sean, carbon, what is it?
Carbon is the basis of life. We hear about organic life. When you hear something is organic, that means life, and it also means carbon. So it's the fundamental, one of the fundamental components in all living things. So carbon-based life forms you hear. You also hear in chemistry inorganic. That means lacking in carbon. So inorganic are dead things, are metals, are materials in the earth that do not have carbon as their basis. So it's really important. Why is it important? It's important because it's quite a stable element. It reacts with a lot of different things. It allows lots of different chemical reactions to happen. And there's quite a lot of it. We're made up of 18% of us is carbon. It's the fourth most common chemical element in the universe. So it is quite common. You were talking earlier about the whole story to do with global warming and things like that. Well, of course, fossil fuels, when we talk about fossil fuels, we're talking about fuels like carbon and turf. In Ireland, we have turf and wood. These have all been created from the death of plants and animals, mainly plants. So the plants die, this organic material is laid down in the earth. Over millions and millions of years is compacted. It becomes turf, then if it's compacted more, it becomes coal. Compacted more, become anthracite. Then this is burnt. So we burn it then. Petroleum is also fossil-based.
And we release the carbon.
Now, there's a misconception, though, that we're actually sending out, that there's more carbon being created all the time in the world. No, there's a finite amount of carbon. It just can get transferred into different forms. So, for example, when we breathe out, we release carbon dioxide. Plants take in carbon dioxide. So there's a balance between ourselves and plants here. That's one thing. The gases that actually cause global warming, that's actually very important for life. I mean, people see it as a very negative thing, this global warming. It's associated in the public mind with something negative. But in actual fact, if you didn't have a certain amount of global warming, we'd all be frozen. There would be no life here on Earth. So what carbon does in the atmosphere is that it allows the sunshine to come into the atmosphere. It's reflected back from the surface of the Earth, and a certain amount of it is captured. So it's like a cooker. It's like a pot heating up. But a certain amount is allowed back out into space as well. So that's a natural balance. The problem is that more and more of this carbon is being released as we use more and more of our fossil fuels, so that the heat, the sunshine, the radiation from the sun that would have been under normal circumstances 50 years ago allowed to go back out into space is now being trapped. Increasingly being trapped. So it's like we're trapped in a cooker that's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. So that's why it's negative. But it's crucial to lots of other things that we can talk about as well. I mean, silicon is a good example of something that has a lot of carbon, and silicon is crucial. I mean, silicon in computers, for example, silicon chips, they're vital. Pencils, graphene. This is all carbon, so
it's not all bad. Okay.
It's not all bad.
Well, listen, I got to leave it there, but you wanted to mention some Irish scientists, was it?
Yeah, there's a Dublin scientist who's doing a trial at the moment for Ebola to try and get a vaccine for Ebola, so we should mention him. He's Professor Adrian Hill. He's director of the Jenner Institute in the university, Oxford University, and he's working with the WHO, and also with the National Institute of Health and GlaxoSmithKline. So we wish him well with that. And there are amazing Irish scientists working in all kinds of brilliant labs overseas, and Professor Hill is one of those.
Excellent. Of course, you're not bad yourself. All right. That is our science, cool scientist, Sean Duke. And you can find out all the work that Sean does on seanduke.com. He's a man from Science Spinning, and he's written the book, 17 Irish Scientists to Change the World.
That's right.
Thanks very much indeed, Sean. Thank you.